It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, Dialogue Conspiracy number 258, and this is February the 28th, 1977, the last day in February. March begins tomorrow. I don't know where the last 2 months went, but years and months go pretty quickly. Around here they do.
I don't know how many of you have seen Network, the movie Network, but I recommend it to you. I will be talking at length about Network in about 2 or 3 weeks, my impression of it, notes I took of it. I even took a tape recorder to the theater to get certain lines from the movie. It's a very important movie for many reasons. It's a play within a play, and it is telling us something, and I think you should see it. I recommend it very highly. There's a scene in there where the gentleman is on the air and television news, and he gets very emotional about what's happening in the world, the pollution in the air and the poison in the food and no air to breathe and the rivers contaminated and the manipulation of the news through the major network channels. And he asks people, how much can you take? Can you go out there, out to the window and say, I'm a human being. I don't want to take this anymore. I don't have to take this anymore. And he encourages people to get to the window and shout and scream. And sometimes I feel like coming into KLRB and screaming and shouting about the news that I compile or collect every day, 7 days a week. I take newspapers, 10 papers a day, and then get clippings from other cities. And I'm going through a large pile of books, getting caught up on various pieces of reading material. And the whole picture of the news comes together like one gross nightmare, and everything looks more dismal. And the piles of court cases, the perversions of courts, the people that are getting off are put into one box to be cross-filed. The people who are getting stiff sentences are put in that box. The perversion of the court, the payoff for criminals such as the Watergate defendants getting $200,000 last week, the stiff sentences still for marijuana in many places, and political prisoners, Black, Chicano, Indian, and then the white-collar criminals, and the higher up they are getting off or their court records locked up in secret. The court records and the death files, the people who are dying, how fast they're dying, where they're coming from, what they were doing when they were killed, such as Freddie Prinze we talked about last week, and the manipulation of the citizens in this country is horrendous. And of course, what I resent more than anything is Jimmy Carter. The gentleman, he looks so peaceful. He's assembled up in the White House with his family, his sons and daughter-in-law, this little girl who attends state dinners, which I think is great. And they look so cozy and comfortable, you know, in that situation. Jimmy Carter doesn't look like if he had a fly swatter, he could hit it. And he hit the fly, and he sits back, and in his very sweet smile, he gets on television and immediately defends payment of foreign leaders, not even knowing where the money goes to, whether it goes for assassins or policemen there. He defends that. He'll defend the CIA and the wartime economy, and eventually he will defend another war. I'm absolutely convinced that the Cold War policy has to continue with a full speed ahead because Jimmy Carter has appointed the people in power who gave us Vietnam. Instead of being put in disgrace, such as the men were at, say, after World War II, the Nuremberg trials, the horrendous things that these men did to our economy and caused, say, a budget of $1 million an hour over there, and the defoliation of the land and the killing of people over there and the way they did it, and the 45,000 GIs, plus another 100,000 or 200,000 that were maimed and are in hospitals or missing, and the displacement of people all over Southeast Asia, and then Jimmy Carter appoints these people to run his cabinet now. So you know with that cast, just as you get a cast in a certain movie, a script writer, a director, and a cast of characters, you pretty well know when they start what the movie or the script is going to be like. So that if, when you read the paper daily and you see sending our fleet now to Africa or getting antsy about Mr. Amin over in Uganda, you know that Jimmy Carter is going to duplicate in many ways the Vietnam scene. And what is so bad is that he appoints Andrew Young, a black man, to head the UN and sends him to Africa, to Rhodesia, so that black meets black and there's the appearance of some semblance of diplomacy. And in the meanwhile, the Middle East and African conferences are heating up. And on the one hand, it looks like he wants peace and that he's talking peace terms, and yet you can see all the signs of a possible confrontation. I think the indifference and the lethargy of the masses has allowed this to happen. The problems abroad are similar to what the people in Germany experienced when Adolf Hitler was in power. Africa is a long way away to us. The Middle East is a long way, just as Southeast Asia is. And as long as the war doesn't hit our soil, or the same kind of a war, nobody's going to pay attention. I don't believe for a minute that the defoliation of our land and the rivers and the pollution and the oil spills is all coincidental. It's all coming in bunches where it never happened before, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But this is the beginning of our problems at home, the weather and the chemical agents being put out and the zombie assassins that are killing on the streets, what we call these senseless crimes. And these massacres, I think, could be studied very seriously, just like you would in a laboratory if it was a scientific affair, and you'd find out what psychiatrists these people had seen, what medical treatment they had, if they were hypnotized, if they had surgical treatment, and try to locate the pinpoint the sources of the violence. I think that the worst ripoff, as I say, of our times or the image making is this Jimmy Carter, who was saying, trust me, I never lie, and yet his actions came through at the time when Gerald Ford won the nomination for president and this last summer in Kansas City. It was the same evening of the provocation of the two gentlemen killed from our armed forces over in South Korea, and immediately Jimmy Carter was met in an airplane in Los Angeles, and they asked him what his reaction was. We sent in airplanes that were flying over the Korean territory. We had ships outside the harbor. It was almost ready to go into war scene right at that point. It could be triggered off just like World War I was when Archduke Franz Ferdinand was murdered. And they asked Jimmy Carter, what do you think of Gerald Ford's actions? And of course, from his old graduate Annapolis days, from his military days, he says, I support the military decision. And I support Gerald Ford, and he didn't have any information or reason to believe that he would support it. And I once said on Dialogue Conspiracy, all he had to say was, I don't have the facts yet, I don't have the evidence. It turned out later, because some news people are a little brighter than they used to be, thank goodness, that the tree incident had been planned, that there was direct provocation, that North Korea had warned in advance that something was cooking up, that the airplanes had been overhead, the troops were ready for this confrontation where those trees were cut down, the cameras were shooting the scene, and a lot of known reason was there came evidence that they knew in advance that there would be a confrontation of this kind, and as soon as it was blown over that it was planned and staged, it was all quieted down. Now, the purpose of that staging was that there was going to be a trial. There had been a trial of dissidents in South Korea, poets and politicians and people not Marxists, but people to the left of the administration there now. And they were to get a harsh sentence that next day and a long-term imprisonment. And the purpose of this was to show how evil the North Koreans were, to create a situation that demanded a response. And the men were sent to prison for a long time, and the whole thing blew over when it was exposed as a provocation. There was a cartoon last Sunday in the paper of Pfeiffer of a small boy speaking to his father, and he said, how did you get your job in the State Department? And the gentleman said, I was wrong on Vietnam. How did you get your job in the Justice Department? I was wrong on civil rights. How did you get your job in HUD, the housing development? I was wrong on the cities. If you were wrong, why were you appointed? The answer is, we were members of the same club. What club? The right club. It's made up of graduates of the right universities who went into the right corporations and made the right contacts. Why were you wrong on the issues? And then the gentlemen say, not by accident. That's a Pfeiffer cartoon. The cartoons are getting about as funny as Mort Saul used to be at the nightclubs talking about the murder of John Kennedy and the conspiracy that killed John Kennedy. Walter Scott answered a question about Jimmy Carter's cabinet in Personality Parade. It said, why is it that Jimmy Carter's cabinet is known in Washington, D.C. as Robert McNamara's Revenge? And the answer was three members of his cabinet, Cyrus Vance, now Secretary of State, Harold Brown, Secretary of Defense, and Joe Califano, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, all worked for Robert McNamara in the Pentagon. They were all in the Pentagon when he was the Secretary of Defense in the Kennedy-Johnson Vietnam era. And like McNamara, they were proved wrong about Vietnam. Undoubtedly, each has learned from his errors, as has Jimmy Carter. This is what Walter Scott says. I challenge the answer, each has learned from his errors. What I believe is each is put back for another shot at war in Africa or the Middle East. There also is a quotation from Jimmy Carter's campaign from Hamilton Jordan, who I read in the paper this morning is moving up in his position in the cabinet. And many of you have heard this, but it bears repetition. He said, if after the inauguration you find a Cyrus Vance as Secretary of the State and Zbigniew Brzezinski as head of the National Security Council, then I will say we failed and I would quit. But that's not going to happen. You're going to see new faces, new ideas. The government is going to be run by people you have never heard of. Now, it turns out that Jimmy Carter's 20 top appointments and Vance and Brzezinski are running those positions. And it seems to me that Mr. Jordan would resign and not work his way up to the White House staff because that's what he said. But these known liars now can just flaunt whatever they said in the past at us, such as not wanting secrecy in the CIA, and then Jimmy Carter coming out last week and not only saying there should be more secrecy, but that 70 or 80 people shouldn't share a given secret about a conspiracy or assassination or whatever, that it should be with a handful of people, which is what the Council of 40 is. The National Security Council is actually five men, and they always gave it the title 40 because it sounded more democratic, but a few people knew the secrets. Well, the newest man to kick around, besides Adolf Hitler and Richard Nixon, is Idi Amin. He's become the bad man in Africa. I don't have any great love for Idi Amin. His model happens to be Adolf Hitler, and he's come out and said that. But that happens to be the model of General Motors or IBM or Exxon or ITT. I don't see where Idi Amin is any different than Nelson Rockefeller or David Rockefeller or any of that gang that supplied the money to IG Farben or ITT that made the weapons that brought the Holocaust down in World War II. Charles Lindbergh supported Adolf Hitler and made airplanes for him. Howard Hughes helped design airplanes for Adolf Hitler. I don't see where Idi Amin is any different than those people, and I don't think he's worse than the governments right now, say, in Brazil, Argentina, Ecuador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, South Africa, Mozambique, Ethiopia, South Korea. There isn't anything different about Idi Amin. The United Press yesterday came out and said that if Robespierre wrote the original book on the Reign of Terror in Europe, Idi Amin of Uganda has added the footnotes. They described him as one of the most brutal regimes of the continent. They said his economy is in ruin, such as salt, sugar, and bread. The bodies are floating in the River Nile like corks up and down the River Nile. That he's killed no fewer than 30,000 people that have disappeared in 6 years, that his reign, his chief justice was dragged in with his own robes to the chambers where the troops killed him, that the Nile and Lake Victoria were clogged with bodies and corpses, that he rules by the gun. They also went on to say Uganda is one of the most fertile nations in Africa. As I say, it has staples of salt, sugar, bread, green hills, and beautiful, fertile ground that could export coffee and tea and everything the Americans enjoy. Now, Uganda is being singled out, and Amin is being singled out because he has played fewer CIA games. He's played some with the terrorists that he didn't know that were funded by the CIA, such as the Palestinian Liberation Group. He allowed them to land their airplane at Entebbe, for which he's sorry, but he played the game not knowing they're funded by members of the Birch Society and the far right wing in this country. And I hope the week after next or next week to go into detail on that. CIA agents are all over Africa. I have the names of the agents in countries like Algeria, Burundi, Cameroon, Central Africa, the African Republic, the Ivory Coast, Dahomey, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kamaki, Kenya, Liberia, Mali, Nigeria, Sudan, Tanzania, Chad. I could name 40 African countries, and I have the list of the particular CIA agents that are in these countries. And what they want of Amin is that he will not play their game, that he is doing it his own way. There is no more terror in the country that he's running than any of these African countries. This can be documented, and the life expectancy of people in South Africa that Ian Smith is running down there in their labor camps and the diamond mines and the gold mines and the forced labor, the life expectancy of taking people away from their wives and families, and they sleep on concrete blocks and die young, and they have death squads, starvation squads, and terror all over these countries, trained by policemen, trained in the United States, and supplied with their weapons and their torture machines. What's going on in Brazil and Argentina and South Korea is nothing any different than what's going on in Uganda. And he's been singled out because he won't play the game, and they want his goodies. And furthermore, they've taken the country that they claim, the United States State Department has claimed, is so evil with the bodies floating around, because they need a foothold in Africa, and they need to get the troops on the coast of Africa. There was an incident just a few weeks ago where some nuns were killed, seven people, priests and nuns, were shot down, and they tried to blame the black terrorists. And immediately there was a response that it was a Mozambique group of provocateurs and terrorists, such as those being trained in Spain now to go into Portugal by the CIA, that actually did the killings. And there's a lot of violence going on, but Africa is wealthy. Nigeria is wealthy for oil, minerals, gold, silver, all the minerals we need for making weapons, and it's a place that has to be taken over by force. Many countries, the Latin American countries, were bought out the last 25 years by our State Department, our ITT, and the Howard Hughes, and the Exxon, and the oil companies, the petroleum countries. But the African countries that haven't been bought out or sold out have to be under our control, and Amin does not want to be controlled by the CIA. He does not have agents of the CIA listed there, and he claims there was a coup to take his life, and it's certainly believable that he could be assassinated. I believe there's people that don't like him, but even in this country we see one series of assassinations after another. So he's the bad boy, and he's the one that we could send the troops in. There's a new movie that's coming out that I haven't seen it. I've heard about it, and I think there's a comparison, though. It's called The Voyage of the Damned, and there's a comparison here that you're going to find in this movie, from what I've heard about it or the reviews I've read, to the Amin situation in Africa and allowing it to build up, or the possibility that we would go through two countries to invade, and once we have the money, and they see American money and cigarettes and what the GIs bring, we'd be, in quotes, welcome to, in quotes, control Amin, or in quotes, to protect Americans. And we have to watch what develops there in terms of this movie, and I just describe it to you briefly, The Voyage of the Dam. It's a true story, and it's about a ship that left St. Louis, a Hamburg American Line luxury, the SS St. Louis, and it went to Germany, and it sailed there May 13, 1939. And that's just the year that Hitler invaded Poland and Jews were trying to leave Germany. It had a cargo of 936 Jewish passengers. And the greatest difficulty with these Jews was choosing what they would leave behind. They left behind all of their possessions, of course, and each one sold what they could and raised a fee of $262 for each person for the passage. And they paid $150 for a land certificate. And the director in Cuba, it was signed by the Cuba's director of immigration, said that for $150 a piece, they could go to Cuba. These were the days before Batista and Castro, but there was a far-right fascist, what we would call a fascist dictator, controlling Cuba's policies at the time. There were 734 refugees, and Cuba was to where they, be where they would go, and then they would fill out their immigration papers and quotas and enter the United States 3 months after they got to Cuba. But what the passengers didn't know when they got on the boat was that the captain had made a deal 8 days before the departure with the president of Cuba, whose name was Frederico Brew, and invalidated all the landing certificates. And the Nazi-instigated anti-Semitism swept the island just like it did in France. The Nazis had been working in France from 1933 until the invasion of France, so that France fell in one day. And the Nazis were working in Cuba. And from the outset, this voyage was designed, I'm reading a review from the San Francisco Chronicle this week, was designed as an intelligence-gathering cover and a cunning Nazi propaganda stroke to demonstrate that the world did not care about the fate of the Jews and would offer little resistance when the final solution of genocide would come along, that these people were to be sacrificed on the voyage of the damned and not be allowed, even though they had paid to go into Cuba, they were not allowed to go there and they could not get into America, and they were to be sacrificed. And the point was that it was all a hoax, and it was to prove to the world that other countries were hard assed about what would happen to the Jews, and they would accept German genocide because they could point to Cuba and America for the chicanery that they played on these people. Now, I believe that several hundred people, Americans, may not be killed in Uganda. Someday they may be killed, but they could be sacrificed. There's going to be a point where certain people in this country are going to be sacrificed that are living either in the Middle East or Africa as an excuse to maintain a foothold to the oil and the energy. If we fight alternative sources of energy such as atomic energy, and we need oil, and we need the oil of Africa and the Middle East, Americans will be sacrificed in that same way as the voyage of the damned. And I don't think that Jimmy Carter would hesitate to send in the troops and begin to get a foothold in Africa. I think with the team that he's lined up in the White House, with the appointments he's made, and what they did in Vietnam and were not punished, it would be identical to sending Bernard Barker and Frank Sturgis and Eugene Martinez out on a mission some night with their burglary kits again and give them another job in the CIA protecting certain hotel rooms or papers or documents. It's giving these people the same keys, the same license, different setting now. We've moved from Vietnam and now we're over in Africa, and we're also breaking up the Entente in Southeast Asia. Speaking of Jimmy Carter, when he was running for president of the United States in June, he made a statement regarding the B-1 bomber. This is the quotation: "Exotic weapons which serve no real function do not contribute to the defense of this country. The B-1 is an example of the proposed system that should not be funded, and it would be wasteful by the taxpayer's dollar." But then, after he was nominated in August, he said, "We should have a continued research on the B-1 bomber and a development program on the B-1 bomber to see if it is necessary in the future." Now he's not really sure. Now that he's elected president, he has a third position. So there's a 1, 2, and 3 on Jimmy Carter. But tomorrow, March the 1st, you as Americans have a chance to let your voices be heard. So I'll give you this telephone number of the White House. You may have heard it before on KLRB, but I'm giving it again for you. Dial 202-456-1414. 202-456-1414. And let the president know at the switchboard whether or not you want the B-1 bomber. The cost of the bomber is equal to homes for 6 million families. 6 million families. The loss of the B-1 bomber, the argument to have it, according to the defenders of it, is that it would mean 200,000 jobs and air superiority. That's what the backers say. 6 million homes would be more than 6 million jobs, because it takes more than one person to build the home. At the height of unemployment, You would have carpets and heating and roofs and foundation and all the services that go into a home. And besides that, there is no low-cost housing going on in the United States to speak of anywhere in this country. Besides the unemployment, there's nowhere for the young or the old or the middle class to move. So if you're not interested in having the B-1 bomber, call 202-456-1414. The bombers cost $100 million for each airplane that goes down. They're already outdated. The bulk of the work would go in Palmdale, California, Rockwell International Plant. That's the same plant that's making electronic fingerprint devices for Chile and Brazil for the military fascist regime. Rockwell has the contract for making the data banks and computers for the most militaristic regimes in the world, practically. The B-1 is enough to educate every child one airplane in Cincinnati for 1 year. The cost of two would clean up the Great Lakes, and the cost of the fleet of 244 would build 6 million American homes. So call that number if you don't want the B-1 bomber. Call tomorrow. That's March the 1st. Jimmy Carter is not only interested in sending troops outside of Africa or ships or working with Idi Amin and making him the bully of this whole situation, because three people were murdered, and this made an outrageous proclamation of the President of the United States, where we're having people killed on our streets literally by the hundreds in crimes that I would like to go into. I have a list here if time allows. But also, he sent a letter purposely at another front, and that was a letter to Sakharov in the Soviet Union. I don't think the heads of state, particularly in a new administration, should be sending letters to a political dissident. The Soviet Union got an answer that it was similar to their writing to Angela Davis at the time that she had a trial, or Eldridge Cleaver, but it's not quite. We really want peace. People are tired of war. We're tired of the Cold War. And at this time that the letter went was just at the time that we're talking about new SALT talks and whether or not we want the B-1 bomber. And the question of scaling down the weapons is a question of whether you're going to have peace with the Soviet Union. So at the one hand, at his campaign, Jimmy Carter can say that he doesn't want the bomber, but now he can rationalize it that we're still at a Cold War basis, but he's creating the Cold War. He can say, I didn't change my campaign slogan, but he really has, because he's provoking errors at three places in the Middle East with King Hussein, in Uganda, in Africa, and also in the Soviet Union. He sent a letter which definitely stirred up internal affairs with the Soviet Union. They sent a message back that it doesn't help the peace talks, that they're offended by the peace talks. They don't appreciate a letter from the President of the United States. Mr. Sakharov isn't in prison. He is out free on the streets. He has never been arrested in his life. Life isn't so tough for him. He's only been warned by the KGB about his activities, but he's never has been arrested. And he is on the outside, and he does see journalists and tourists and people that come to him from Amnesty International, and he isn't that badly off. And the Soviet Union answered with a message from San Francisco. It was a tape that was sent to Moscow, and there's a copy of it that was in the paper this week. And this is what goes back to the Soviet Union to answer the letter that Jimmy Carter sent about human rights in the Soviet Union. This is to TASS, a telegram, San Francisco, TASS correspondent. It says, tens of thousands of foreign workers arrive in the United States every year in search of work. The heaviest influx are foreign-born laborers who come during harvest time, and some of them return home while others remain in the United States. The immigration authorities often shut their eyes in the United States to violation of immigration rules. They import cheap labor, especially Mexican and other Latin American countries. They wait for the immigrants, and they are slave labor. Their earnings are one-third of those of the other American citizens. The attitude of these people in the USA is outside racism. And this is signed from a member of the Soviet embassy to TASS. On another wire, he said, the hardest lot is that of immigrants working in the California state. That about 24% of all foreign labor in the United States is slave labor. The immigrants come in the United States and get the hardest jobs on the farms and their plantations, or public jobs such as washing dishes and cleaners. They are paid a mere pittance. They pay their federal tax, but they get no unemployment insurance, social insurance, or benefits, which are paid to American citizens. A poll held by Litton & Company among those that detained illegal immigrants showed that 73% of them have to pay their federal taxes to the United States, but 4% of them had their children attending school. You get the message. I'm sure in the Soviet Union there's 100% attendance in school. And what the Soviet agent is sending to TASS in response to Jimmy Carter's message, a third telegram to TASS, even an insignificant offense by any slave laborer is an excuse for expelling the immigrant. The form immigrants are required to fill in if they get into trouble with the authorities includes points of expulsion, such as if they carry any contagious disease, have a previous conviction, whether or not the immigrant is a member of the Communist Party. The number of immigrants is limited to 20,000 a year, but apart from this coercive measure, the authorities do nothing to end the crying social and political ruthlessness and ruthless economic exploitation of foreign workers. Now, that is what TASS is getting from San Francisco to the United States, and that's their answer to Jimmy Carter. Now, at a time when Jimmy Carter has a third front besides Africa and the United States to stir up, this last week was all this talk about the money going to King Hussein. The Washington Post printed an article that said the payment started in 1957. That's incidentally the year that the Sirhan family was brought over from the Palestinian front when Israel took over what was Palestine. The Sirhan family was given a large amount of money and brought to Pasadena, where a home was bought for them through the Jordanian Council, through the CIA Greek Orthodox Church. That was in 1957. And starting in 1957, payments went, millions of dollars were sent to King Hussein. Hussein said the report on the CIA that they paid for guards for his children was based on a request he made to the State Department. And then he replied, if Amy Carter goes to school in Jordan, she would also have protection. But we know that millions of dollars going to King Hussein went to something more than guarding his children at school in America. King Hussein said last week that the people who contributed to the story that he was receiving money from the CIA at this time were sabotaging the Middle East peace efforts. It is hardly coincidental that these attacks were made as the peace offensive was picking up steam on the very day that Secretary of State Cyrus Vance arrived in Amman. Now, who were the people who were breaking this up that he fingered? Bob Woodward of the Washington Post is the man who broke the story. Gerald Ford knew about the Hussein story. Jimmy Carter knew about it before he came in power. The day that the story broke by the Washington Post about King Hussein getting this money was the day that Cyrus Vance was supposed to be making peace over there in the Middle East. So what you have is Jimmy Carter appointing a war cabinet, and Cyrus Vance always represented the war in Vietnam, and all the men on his cabinet represent nothing but war. So what are you getting at the two sides of Jimmy Carter? He can send one person, Andrew Young, to Africa, but he can begin to get the troops warmed up to go into Uganda, singling out Idi Amin, who is much less offensive than 20 other countries in Africa and rich in natural resources, who won't play our game. He sends Andrew Young there pretending to want peace and stirring up Uganda. He sends Cyrus Vance to King Hussein, knowing that that story is going to break, and Bob Woodward is breaking it. So Carter could say, I want peace, but the peace talk breaks. Then he purposely, at the time of the talks where we're going to the Russians on disarmament, and he says, we want disarmament, he writes to Andrei Sarkov and begins in the Soviet Union steaming up this Cold War again on three fronts. Jimmy Carter is no juggler. He's a peanut farmer who was $5 million in debt and appointed the banker, Mr. Lance, head of Office of Management Budget, who handled his loans, to become a high position in the cabinet. He knows what he's doing. He graduated from Annapolis. He graduated in the Atomic Submarine Division. He's a military man from the word go. He says, I want peace, but the appointment of his cabinet tells you what he wants. That tells you right there, because, as I say, they gave you the Vietnam War. So on one side, he sits back and pretends that Russia, Africa, and Middle East are ripe open for peace. And then with the help of the Washington Post again, good old Bob Woodward, who's fingered by King Hussein himself, he says the people who did this are responsible for closing off peace. Another quotation, it's from John Wallach, Examiner, San Francisco Examiner, last Sunday. CIA scandal is a blow to peace hopes. Another article, the intelligence scandal involving allegations that millions of dollars of CIA payoffs went to Jordan's King Hussein couldn't come at a worse time for American efforts to promote a peaceful settlement in the Middle East. The scandal broke hours before Secretary of State Vance's arrival, and it immensely complicates the remaining part of his mission to persuade leaders of Syria and Saudi Arabia to turn to Hussein an increasing role in the peacemaking process. Now the fate of the Geneva Conference appears clouded because of probable damage to Hussein's prestige in the Arab world. Less than 24 hours before those revelations were made public by the Washington Post, by Bob Woodward, the Egyptian President Anwar Sadat proposed a Jordanian-Palestinian confederation that would have strengthened Hussein's hand, and now it's complicated the peace. We had President Eisenhower wanting a peace in 1959 when Lee Harvey Oswald from the Minsk Radio Factory and Gary Powers down the U-2, Powers was exchanged for Mr. Abel, the spy, and he was alive, and Oswald was brought home with his money from the State Department. We saw the peace talk sabotage, Madame Chenault and Lyndon Johnson and Thieu and Key in Vietnam sabotaging 1967, 68, the peace talks to keep that war going till 1972 and use it as a rallying point for Richard Nixon. And now in 1977, we see the peace talks sabotaged again. You can't say it's coincidence because the same people are doing it. And I resent Jimmy Carter's speech about those three people that were killed in Uganda. I think it's terrible they were killed there. I know it's terrible. But have you heard him say anything about that police link in Los Angeles, those California murders? This woman, Ellen Ann Delia, that went to Sacramento, when she got to the airport, she was kidnapped and killed because she was going to expose some money irregularities in financing of projects for prisoners when they got out of prison. She was slain exactly like Karen Silkwood, who was meeting an agent of the New York Times. And when it turned out that she had been murdered, then there was a link to eight other persons that were murdered in the case, and now there's a link to 20 people, and all of a sudden that's off the press because there's a possibility that an assemblyman in Sacramento and his office is involved, the area that this money came from. Does Jimmy Carter care about Ellen Anna Delia, the prisoners in America get out and want a halfway house, a place that her husband is running for some Chicanos and offenders that need a break when they get out, and instead of them getting this halfway house, it's a project called Get Going. Instead of them getting it, the people with the right connections taking these Mexican-American prisoners and not giving an opportunity are killing a woman because she wants to tell the assemblyman and the proper authorities that the money is going in the wrong hands. Chicano Americans in prison who want a break to get out can't get it because the funding is going away from them, and 20 murders are involved, and that's right in California. And does our president, Jimmy Carter, have any statement about that? He's just like all the other presidents. He can talk about murders way overseas, about Idi Amin and Uganda. Does he talk about Ellen Marie Delia? Here's an article that a listener from Sacramento sent me. It wasn't even on the newspapers, the wire service I take it, the UPI story. It's about a man named Sanford Radinsky, Houston, Texas. And it was sent to me. This is from the Sacramento Bee, February 13th. Two women were arrested in a raid at a fashionable hotel with an attorney, a wealthy attorney by the name of Sanford Hilton Radinsky. Radinsky happens to have long hair and a beard. He has a hippie-type look to him. There's a photograph, and he's a wealthy attorney. He's in a hotel room with two women at the Rice Rittenhouse Hotel in Houston, Texas. The policeman knocked on the door and said, "Room service." The women answered the door. They knocked down the door and shot this man. And he began to yell, "I'm killed, I'm dead, I'm dead." But they weren't satisfied. They riddled him with bullets and killed him in cold blood. Radinsky was past president of the Texas Association of Finance Companies. They shot him like the FBI shot Fred Hampton in Chicago a few years ago. And he had no chance to shoot back. He was shot in the chest, the back, the legs, the wrist, the shoulder. Six shots were fired through a door at him. And the women that were with him were charged for possessing marijuana and were held for $1,000 each. They had marijuana, and they're on a bond for $1,000 each, and an attorney, a wealthy attorney, is shot down in a hotel room in Houston, Texas, by the police, and they had some marijuana. What is Jimmy Carter doing about that? I see an article in the Washington Post this week, February the 20th, that a man named David Allen Etheridge got 120 years in jail, a sentence, 120-year jail term. What was his crime? 49 LSD tablets, 1 ounce of marijuana, and 1/8 of an ounce of phenobarbital. You notice that the doctor that gave the gun back to Freddie Prinze when he killed himself, the psychiatrist, hasn't been charged for malpractice. The doctor in Las Vegas that gave him 100 Quaaludes before he took this weapon that was provided by the psychiatrist hasn't been charged. But here's a man that just went to jail. This isn't 20 years ago. This isn't at the height of the hippie COINTEL program. I'm talking about this week's news, 120-year concurrent. The David Allen Etherton got 120 years for 1 ounce of marijuana, selling it, 49 LSD tablets, and 1/8 of an ounce of phenobarbital. He's to get 40 years, three terms, running concurrently. And that is where he's being put into prison. This is from the Washington Post, from the Virginia Department of Corrections. An officer in Oakland has been identified for killing a gentleman on the street last week. He was in a police car with it, no lights flashing, no siren on, going 60 miles an hour and ran over them. A union figure who organized a strike in Las Vegas is missing, identical to Jimmy Hoffa. Al Bramlett led a kitchen strike last year, which was his legal right to do a culinary union. His body is missing. They fear foul play, like Jimmy Hoffa. He's gone. A British research team is openly and promoting bacteriological organisms that are for sale by Western nations to cause influenza and lung infections and pneumonia and stomach infections. Did Jimmy Carter tell England he doesn't want them to manufacture that? In Michigan right now, a farmer who lost all of his dairy cows and became ill under the chemical PBP had a new barn built, and now all his cows have died from the new barn. The 332 animals were wiped out in 1975, and now the chemical was so strong that even new wood brought into the land is wiping out his whole second fleet, and they all have to be killed. Out of 204 healthy animals, only 100 are left now. The man is sick. He's lost all of his savings, and many people in Michigan are dying from this chemical, just from wood that was in the neighborhood that they built a new barn. I have a pile of articles, the Keypone chemical that was in Virginia in the river, the toxic poisons that are in the Ohio River spilling now, the lye that's on your pretzels, the vendor slayer that was killed in New York last week. He ran the lottery there. There was $1 million life insurance on him, and then he was murdered by the people who would inherit. I have a list of murders here and 1 minute to go, and maybe next week or the week after I'll just do about 40 or 50 horrendous crimes that Jimmy Carter can't talk about that equal what Idi Amin did to three people over there. I'm not saying he was right to murder those three people, but there's so much going on in this country, and Carter is using that for a war, and the war is really here. I won't go into the murders next week. Paul Krasner, the publisher of The Realist, is going to be down in Carmel, and I think I'll have him for my guest on Dialogue Conspiracy next week. We haven't been on a show together for a long time, and he is one of the most courageous publishers in America. He has stopped The Realist, and he's broke, and I think his problems came from publishing the first story in the country that I did on CIA and Watergate, why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped, and then the SLA is the CIA. Paul was not popular with the leftists, with the crowd he used to know, the new left. They didn't like the links of the CIA to the SLA. They wanted to believe in that horrendous kidnapping and the cover story the media projected. And Paul had a lot of courage to print it, and he'll be in Carmel next week, and we'll talk about that. Well, maybe the week after we'll get to some of these horrendous murders, but our time is up for now.